genre.
Welcome back to The Doctor's Companion Presents Doctor Who, The Long Way Round, the weekly podcast where we review and discuss every episode of Doctor Who, one doctor at a time. I'm Nick Jimenez.
I'm Scott Carelli.
And I'm Cass Fredrickson.
And today on the show, we'll be discussing Bad Wolf and the Parting of the Ways, the Ninth Doctor's 10th and final story. We've done it. We've come to the end of our beloved Ninth Doctor's television adventures.
Mm-hmm. We're saying goodbye to Eccleston. I know we had previously mentioned on the show the idea of maybe doing his Big Finish stuff or going to the War Doctor stuff on Big Finish. And I just think that in terms of the Eccleston stuff, I take into question how close to canon his Big Finish stories feel, because of just the timing of everything. I believe I might be misremembering this, but I think that all of his Big Finish stuff takes place between when he leaves on the TARDIS the first time at the end of Rose and then returns. Like at the very end of Rose, like the TARDIS disappears and then comes back and he says, did I mention that it travels in time? And then she runs into the TARDIS. All of his adventures take place between those two spots.
What? That's weird.
Yeah, it's very weird. Because they have to shoehorn it in somewhere to make it make sense because, you know,
yeah.
He Rose is his only companion. And apparently Eccleston was very adamant about that. So he has no companion in his entire Big Finish run. He just has like a new person that he befriends in each episode. But he's a kind of a solo doctor, which I don't really have any interest in. And then the War Doctor stuff kind of got, you know, shot in the foot by John Hurt passing away. Mm-hmm. I think he did 3 series or 4 series of that, and then it never really had an ending. And instead, now they've just gone back, and now they're doing like War Doctor Origins, where they've gotten a sound alike that sounds like a young John Hurt, and then he's doing War Doctor stuff from like earlier in the Time War. I don't know. It all just feels very like, I don't know if that's really worth exploring, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, we are saying goodbye to Eccleston. This is the last time we will talk about a Ninth Doctor story. How are you guys feeling about saying goodbye to our first Doctor in The Long Way Around?
I feel like we're all kind of like passing a bottle of liquor and a brown bag around in a circle. You know?
Yeah.
Remembering pop pop.
Yeah. It's true.
I vividly remember, to skip to the end, I'm sure I've talked about this on an episode of TDC in the past, but I really remember sitting down in my like living room watching this on TV for the first time and being so bummed and angry when Eccleston regenerated,
mm-hmm.
because he was like my first Doctor. He was like my introduction to the whole show. So I remember when he turned into David Tennant, I'm like, oh, they replaced him with some friggin' handsome boy. But he's not my Doctor. For like a whole summer, I was like grumpy about it. And
yeah,
I forget that because I've gone on to love all the subsequent Doctors so much that you know, but I can still remember like really feeling genuinely sad to let this version of the character go. It really felt like scary. I mean, I remember being right there with Rose emotionally when it was happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know it had been spoiled, but I guess my ignorance of the show, because, you know, this being like 2005 and it was airing in England and I was pirating it through a torrent site, because it wasn't even airing in America yet. Like Sci-Fi Channel hadn't started airing it. I had seen that David Tennant, I don't know, I think the first look at David Tennant as the Doctor first time I knew that he was playing the Doctor was the image of his like first costume. That very first image of him like standing by the TARDIS in the costume with the sneakers and everything. Mm-hmm. And I think that might have come out after. I know he was announced as the 10th Doctor before the end of series one, but I think that was mostly done by like British trades. So I don't think I had any idea that Eccleston was going out until I was watching this episode and was like flabbergasted. this one knocked me on my ass.
That's funny.
Back in 2005. I'll also say, after the 60th anniversary specials, seeing literally the first image of 10 was like kind of weirdly transcendent. Like, I don't know.
Like,
it felt so weird.
He's such a baby.
He's a little baby. And I was also just being like, oh, you're going to get such a happy ending.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, oh, you don't have anything to worry about.
We'll talk about that next week.
Yeah.
Well, I had kind of an emotion. I was thinking during the final moments of Parting of the Ways is like, wow, I'm watching 10 being born.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like the romance of it and like the sweeping, like the rose of it all. It's like, wow, all of this is like being like a potion concocting the Doctor that we're about to meet. And like, oh, no wonder he's the way that he is, because like this is so operatic and crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, man.
Gentlemen, I had a question real quick for all three of you, mm-hmm. Or for all three of us. You know, the other third person on the show I never refer to.
Yeah. The one we don't let talk.
The silence.
The rabbit.
Yeah.
So what for each of you individually, was there a moment in either of these stories or a frame or a shot or something where you were like, wow, this came out in 2005.
I feel like this whole two-parter is very dated. Like I'm not fond of the game show of it all. Like sure. I like it both feels of its time, but also like it's good science fiction because, like, you know, it's using the it's like reflecting the present through like the lens of the future, you know? So mm-hmm. like I like the commentary. I think the commentary is still like pretty timely, unfortunately, but I feel like a lot of it is very, very dated. And I didn't watch this for the first time when it was airing. I started watching Doctor Who the summer before the Tennant specials, like the summer before he regenerated. Wow. So I like binged all of it. And like even back in like 2009, I was just like, wait, what is this? This is really weird. And I don't feel like there's aspects of it that I still like, but I feel like a lot of it's dated.
Yeah, it is dated, but in a, I don't know, I find it dated in a charming way because it's just so campy. And I just know that Russell was just cackling in his room alone while he was writing this stuff. So like Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really bother me. But the stuff that I thought was like very 2005 was, it was the game show stuff, but it was specifically like the stuff that the contestants were wearing. I was like, this is supposed to be how many thousands of years in the future? And you guys are dressed like it's 2005. Like everyone is dressed like it's 2005, which I thought was very funny. Yeah. And obviously the, what was her name? She's not like an operator. What is she? She's like a, anyway, very, very inspired by Minority Report, which was like a fairly new movie.
I think she was called the Controller.
Controller. Yeah, yes. Yeah. That being so ridiculously inspired by, Minority Report. I think that maybe dates it. I don't want to say the most, but it dates it quite a bit.
No, I mean, she looks like like something from a after school afternoon Canadian sci-fi show.
Yeah. Or like Farscape.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think I did find it. I think I may have even found it more charming and pleasant now than I did in 05, because like I was a teenager then, and you never think your era is cool when you're living in it.
Yeah.
Like, I hated Don't You by the Pussycat Dolls back then. I thought it was like the lame corporate. But now when I hear it, I'm like, oh, we were so young. Like, I remember going to middle school dances and stuff. So.
Oh my God.
But yeah, so much. I think to me, there's a shot of all the Daleks streaming out of the ships with like really dramatic music playing that really did feel like a Wing Commander cutscene.
Sure.
But sure. Again, I mean, like, that's kind of the charm of Doctor Who, is that it never had, like, you know, the biggest budgets or whatever. But really what I found myself thinking about now that I've gone back and watched a lot of Classic Who since this two-parter is, like, what a huge dial-up in, like, drama this was and for the show, and, like, how much energy RTD was putting into this finale, into these two episodes. Mm-hmm. I kind of have, like, a newfound respect for that.
Yeah, I find that every time I rewatch this two-parter, I'm either really on board for Bad Wolf, or I am just like waiting for the Daleks to show up and get to the point. And this time I was really into it. So I don't know what that says about my mood right now, but I really loved the first part of this, really loved the whole thing. And I think what I really took away from it this time was just how well structured this season is. Like this like series one is so well structured, the way that it like, you don't know that it's building scaffolding to the finale until you get to the finale and you're like, holy shit, that's what the whole series has been about. Wow.
Yeah.
It's really cool. You know, even the episode we didn't like very much, The Long Game, you know, it's like it's like he titled that as like a wink to be like, yeah, no, you're going to want to pay attention to this one because it's going to be important later.
I think that's part of why I'm not as into this one. Because I don't really like care for that episode much. And then like, you know, like this is like the payoff of that. And like the fallout of it. And it's just like, really, the episode that I don't care about? Like, but yeah. But like, and I think that it's very smart because like, you know, by the end of it, like I do care about it. By the end of this two-parter, but it's just like getting to the point is a little tedious for me.
Mm. That kind of reminds me of the frustration that we felt the first time we watched the Battle of Ranskor Avkolos and realized that like this was all leading to Tim Shaw again. Uh-huh. And I can imagine Chibnall or the producer be like, oh, and it's going to be such this cool moment where like, oh, the cool villain that everyone loved from The Woman Who Fell to Earth, he's back, and it was him the whole time. And like I kind of was like, oh, that is kind of cool how he dovetailed it and brought it back to that first episode or second episode. But yeah, if you found that one to be pretty mediocre, that's not what's going to be what gets you to kind of scoot forward in your chair.
Right.
Right. Right. It's funny that you mentioned that because I'm going to circle back to that when I get into the background and significance of this story. But yeah, I mean, it's more than just the long game because you also have, you know, obviously you have the bad wolf stuff. And granted, I don't think that it's as well done as it is in series two with Torchwood, and especially not as well done as Saxon in series three, which I think is like the best time that he's done the secret word. Like, what does it mean? You know, season long arc. I think the Saxon stuff was probably the best executed of those. But you have the bad wolf stuff, but you also have End of the World, and you know the human empire, and that whole thing is set up, you know, only to be like, well, then we go back in time with the long game, and now we see how the future has changed here because we're back, kind of where we, you know, kind of where End of the World was, and everything is different, and why. I think if anything, this story lacks scale. And I don't mean that in terms of like the Daleks. There's lots of Daleks, even if they do look like a Wing Commander cutscene. But I think it lacks like Earth context. You don't see anyone watching the shows that they're in, except for the people in the control room.
Right.
So you don't really know how it's affecting the world outside of like Nine's friend that he makes in the Big Brother house.
Yeah, Linda with a Y.
Yeah, Linda with a Y.
Mm-hmm.
Telling
she
him.
Has line. Yeah, she'll have lines like, everyone watches the games back on Earth. Like, why wouldn't we? But there's no like cutting back to a family watching it and like eating dinner.
Yeah,
people are getting vaporized,
which feels like that. That is such a Russell T. Davies like staple. That it feels weird that it's not here, that context isn't part of this.
Checking in on the mild-mannered British family.
Yeah. especially because, like, you know, I'm sure, I'm not saying that it would be, like, cheap, but you're talking about a bunch of day players shot on a second unit because none of the main actors are part of it, you know? So, I don't know. I do miss that a little bit in this.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely comes back in season two's finale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
We'll talk about.
That being said, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to see how you guys feel about it.
Okay.
Is this, in at least in New Who, is this the best regeneration story in New Who?
What?
What a question.
Because the thing,
what's the one where 12 turns into 13 called?
Twice upon a time.
That one's really good.
It is good. I think what I like about this one, see, I think this one is good, is my favorite still to this day. And I think the reason is that it's just an adventure. There's no like, oh, he's a coming. Get ready. The next doctor's on his way or her way or their way or whatever. I don't know what am I going to have two heads? I don't know. It's not as like, it doesn't have the buildup. It just is like, oh, he died saving his companion.
It's on the job, so to speak.
Right. Exactly. There's not. Yeah. You know, I think 10's exit is just so ridiculously big and epic. That it's a little too much. I think 11's is, I like that story and I defend that story, but it's a lot of checking boxes of like, okay, what else didn't we talk about? Okay, we gotta do this, we gotta do this, and this, this. And then, you know, and then 12 is really fun, but it's like literally an examination about what it means to let go of being the doctor and all of these things. Like, it's just this big, like, philosophical, you know, look at all of that process. 13s felt like a anniversary special. And, you know, I guess like 14s pretty good.
14s is pretty cool.
14s is pretty cool. I'll give you that. 14s is pretty cool. I almost don't count it, though, because it's almost like, you know, I don't know. It feels like a, I don't know. But anyway.
It's funny.
Yeah. I don't know.
I think I'm wondering if, like, because you know, by the time 10 regenerates, like, Doctor Who has become, like, this, like, multinational, like, phenomena, and it only kind of goes into, like, the Matt Smith era. And, like, I like that this one's kind of, like, low-key, even though it's not. It's, like, one of the most, like, high-energy, like, episodes of the season, because it's like the finale, but it feels almost like a classic Doctor regeneration, in that it's just like, oh, here we are on an adventure, and oh no, I died.
Yes.
And because the companion carries over, like, the, I think that that feeds into it too, and like, because the show had been off the air at this point for a while. Mm-hmm. And he's like reintroducing that concept to people, and so I don't, it's not my favorite, but I understand how important it is, I think.
Yeah.
I had the idea watching the end of Parting of the Ways was like, this was my first Who finale.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
And I had no memory of this pressing play on Max. I was like, I didn't even remember the Daleks were in this, to be honest.
Wow.
And, but going back, I'm like, oh my God, I remember getting so hyped at this moment and this moment, because I had no template. I had no, what's happening? Mm-hmm. And I think he gets better at writing these epic two-parters. I think there are, you know, there's some that I like more than others going forward, but it's like RTD got this kind of big epic format down to a science. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so watching this is kind of like the first go around, and like, yeah, there's some really cool moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about the development of Bad Wolf, The Parting of the Ways, or as it was originally titled, Game Show World! !
Oh my God.
So the final episodes aired on the 11th of June and the 18th of June in 2005. And Russell T. Davies was first approached about the revival of Doctor Who in 1998. And it took a while for that to get going. But when he was asked about possibilities for different kinds of episodes, in August of 2000, he actually like made a pitch for this episode that would eventually become Bad Wolf. And so this has been in the works for a long time. Now, the whole time, he had, originally the space station was run by a mentally enhanced teenager named Edward, which I can only imagine he cut, because that's very similar to Cowboy Bebop. Isn't Ed a mentally enhanced teenager? Isn't that a thing? I think it's a thing. I don't know. I'm getting blank stares from them, so I don't think either of them have seen Cowboy Bebop.
Well, yeah, no, don't expose me like this.
Yeah, fair enough.
Oh, wow. I'm more surprised for you than me.
Yeah.
fair enough. Anyway, the game station reusing Satellite 5. Funnily enough, the long game was not meant to be a setup for this, but it became a setup to save money. Because they were like, right, well, we got this set.
That's
so
fair.
Yeah, let's just reuse it again. So from its inception, he wanted the masters of the game station to be revealed to be the Daleks, and wanted to set up the menace of a lone Dalek in Robert Shearman's story, Dalek, earlier this season. And now his intention was like, okay, so you were scared of one Dalek. Now I'm going to show you a fleet of Daleks so you can really understand how terrifying this would be. Mm-hmm. So he's fully how going cool like alien to aliens with Dalek mm-hmm. to Daleks. But there was a mild problem because in England, when you are a television writer for the BBC, they allow you to own any characters that you create in the episodes that you write for their shows. As a result, Terry Nation owned the Daleks, or the Terry Nation estate. And so they entered into negotiations to be able to license the Daleks again on the new series of Doctor Who. And originally, it was not going particularly well. It took 6 weeks or something like that in order for a deal to be reached with the Terry Nation estate. At this time, Davies was like, okay, well, I don't know if we're going to be able to get the Daleks. So going back to what you were saying about Nick, about Tim Shaw, Russell T. Davies was like, okay, I'll just create like an original character and we will introduce one of them in the Robert Shearman story. And then we will introduce a fleet of them later on. And these were the Spheres, which would later appear as the Toclophane in Sound of Drums, Last of the Time Lords at the end of series 3. So originally he made Robert Shearman rewrite Dalek to have a single,
like a floating orb.
Yeah, single floating orb. To be like, yeah, this thing is scary. And then so that when there is a fleet of them running a game show network, the series finale could hopefully have teeth. Pun intended with the Tim Shaw reference.
God damn it.
That was a possibility situation for a while. It's for 6 weeks.
It's so crazy to think
about. Yeah. Almost didn't have Daleks in this series of Doctor Who. And with, you know, with the structure of the RTD1 era being, oh, we're going to reintroduce a Doctor Who big bad each season. That being like so definitively the structure in retrospect,
yeah,
it would be fascinating if this entire first series had no returning villains. That would be bonkers. But
Goebbels, yeah, they're coming.
Yes, the spheres.
the spheres of existential uncomfortableness.
Yeah. Oh boy. And then the Bad Wolf stuff was just sort of incidental, and he just started like putting it in his little Easter eggs and episodes. He had absolutely no idea what it meant. And then he decided in this episode to like name the company Bad Wolf. And I think that it's As intriguing as it is, as you go through, I truly feel like the payoff is questionable at best in this. I don't know. It doesn't quite hit for me. What do you guys think?
I always remember it also being an acronym for something.
Yeah.
The way Torchwood is.
Yeah. I know. But it's not. It's just Bad Wolf. Bad Wolf, whatever. Bad Wolf Studios, whatever it's called. He's like, why do they call it that? I don't know. They just call it that. I don't know. And the thing about like the Bad Wolf chalk, and Rose being like, oh, it means I can go back, and I'm like,
does it though?
How? Like what? Where are you? How are you jumping to that conclusion? I just don't know. So I don't know that the Bad Wolf stuff really worked for me in this. But I don't know. I guess it's, I don't know.
I remember at the time it was like the first time a TV show had been like, hey, did you notice this thing?
Mm-hmm.
This has been going on the whole time. Did you notice? And it was like, oh, I'm supposed to really pay attention to these TV shows that I watch.
Yeah, and that's true.
That begat like Lost and Buffy and all this stuff after that.
That's very true. Yeah. The Christopher Eccleston thing, you know, I think we talked about this early in the series, but like after that first production block, he was out and basically informed everybody that this would be his one and only series with the show.
Mm-hmm.
And so his regeneration had to be written in. And, you know, I think that ultimately, I think that's why it's such a satisfying regeneration for me, because it wasn't like thought up way in advance, you know?
Yeah.
No one went into this being like, oh, this is going to be the Ninth Doctor's regeneration story. It's just a really good story that then they had to write in him regenerating. And I think that's pretty cool. I don't know. I really like it.
Cause it's not like it's not like the focal point of the episode. It's just kind of like almost like a denouement thing. Like this is the fallout of the episode and not like the entire point.
Right. It's a surprise.
Yeah.
And I like it especially in retrospect. I mean, I don't think it's what Russell was doing. Cause there's this funny thing that about Captain Jack. Originally Jack was going to continue and being an ongoing companion.
Mm-hmm.
That was the plan. And he was just going to be a companion now. And he had to be written out of the show because he felt that if Eccleston was going to regenerate, he needed to do that with just Rose, because he felt that Jack, being from the future, may know about Time Lord regeneration, and therefore it would sort of like take the drama out of the moment if Jack knew that he was going to be fine and it was just going to be like, you know, because Jack doesn't mince words, so like it wouldn't make sense for him to like dance around what's going to happen. He would just be like, yeah, so he's going to like light up like a Christmas tree and then he's going to be somebody else but the same person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that's what Jack would say. And so he was like, yeah, so I got to write him out of the show. And as a result of that, writing him out of the show, he was like, well, I don't want to abandon him. I like this guy a lot and I like this character a lot. So spinoff ? And then that begat eventually Torchwood. And he told John Barrowman this on the set, to be like, hey, I know I told you were like the new companion and I'm sorry that we have to like drop you right now, but just know we're going to circle back to you in the future. Don't worry about that. So he was sad to leave the show, but happy that he wasn't finished playing that character. But also, Captain Jack was the reason that he became a companion early in the, toward the end of the season, was that he wanted someone with a military background, a character with a military background, to like help with the like war planning of the battle with the Daleks in the finale. Like, that's why he was sort of like building him up to be with them this whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say what I'm going to say next, I know that this wasn't done on purpose. It's just like nice how things work out. But the fact that when Moffat takes over and he sort of like retcons 9 as this guy who is getting over what he did in the Time War, and he's this sort of like representation of guilt, and how he's relearning how to connect with humanity. And so the fact that like this whole series ends up like Eccleston's arc is about trying to reconnect with humanity, with like the single person after being this guy who was at war killing, you know, countless Time Lords and Daleks and whatever for the greater good, right? And his arc ultimately being, I'm going to sacrifice myself to save one person is kind of great. I love that as Eccleston's story arc. And so I love his regeneration because of that. But that is all mostly retcon stuff, but it just works so well, in the context of like sort of the grand scheme of everything, because if Russell T had planned it that way, I don't think he would have worried about having Captain Jack there, because obviously the Doctor has a military background. But I don't think he necessarily fully knew that at this point.
Well, I don't think it's entirely retcon, because there's that part in, I think it's Parting of the Ways, when the Dalek Emperor is like, where were you in the Time War or whatever? And he says that he was like, am I confusing things? Maybe I'm confusing the two. Maybe I'm confusing the story with the one we're talking about next week.
I think there might be a 10 line.
Yeah. So I don't know. Because Eccleston is very much like even the choice that he's given, like, you know, like, I'm going to destroy the Daleks once and for all, but mm-hmm. I'm also going to like sacrifice the planet potentially. Mm-hmm. And then he sends Rose away. And like the only reason that like she comes back, I don't know. I don't think it's entirely retcon. I think like some of it is like the kernel of that is there.
Mm-hmm.
In like the writing and the performances in this.
Yeah. I just think, I don't know. I guess I would like to credit Moffat for, I don't know, fleshing all of that out a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. In that, I'm not saying this is a criticism of Russell T. Davies. I love when writers fly by the seat of their pants and it works out. That's our entire time on Geek by Night.
Yes.
it's just, I don't know. I like that. Like, I just think, I think that being able to fly by the seat of your pants and having it work out just actually shows that you're a really great writer just naturally. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. I love it. I love Eccleston's arc this season. Nick, what do you think about all that?
That makes me think of, you know, we're even seeing him do that now in 2024, where mm-hmm. we're seeing just with the 3/14 specials and Ruby Road, which is what we have so far time of recording, how much connective tissue that has offered, to where now I'm kind of thinking about 12 differently. Like, mm-hmm. knowing where 14 ends and how that kind of recontextualizes this whole journey we've been on, and 13, what 13 was going through, and validating that. And mm-hmm. it's cool to, it's a strength of his as a writer that he's kind of had his entire time working on this show.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. So continuing on from there, interesting stuff. Originally the intention for the big, like, oh, Jackie shows up with a truck to, you know, pop open the TARDIS console. That was originally going to be, the return of the modern day versions of her friends, Bev, Sarah, and Susie. The three young women in Father's Day, they were going to return as like her older friends, and they were all going to show up with cars and chain all their cars together and go. Instead of just like the big truck, but instead of all of her friends returning, they just changed it to an off-screen boyfriend, which is
Antonio.
Yeah. Very Jackie.
That's so
Rodrigo.
Rodrigo.
And then, with the Eccleston departure, Davies and Gardner promised that his departure would be kept a secret, and so they had a fake section of the script in which the Doctor does not regenerate, and that's the one that was circulated with everyone. And instead, at the end of the episode, like the end of the season, Nine and Rose are like on the TARDIS together, and Rose is like, where to next? And he's like, oh yeah, yeah, another adventure. And then he looks at a TARDIS like console screen and sees like the outline of Rose on the screen, and then it says that like she's terminal. So like the idea being like, oh, that's going to be the thing next season, is that like Rose is dying and he has to figure out a way to save her. That was the script that everyone thought was the end of the season, like most of the crew. And then they got a skeleton crew in to do the regeneration. And then all that work was for nothing because it got leaked to the press anyway. Because
that sucks.
Well, you know, here's the thing about workman crew members in Britain. If there's a dollar, they're going to get it because they don't give a shit about any of this. They're there to do a job. Is it 5 o'clock? Oh, I'm done. We're done. Clock out. We'll finish tomorrow. So they're very much, very much that mentality. And, you know, yeah, if there's a dollar to be had by from some information, you know, they're going to make that dollar. I hope that guy got paid a lot of money, whoever leaked it. I assume it was a man. I hope it was worth it. So let's see what else we got. We got the voices of all of the hosts of all of the game shows. They all did cameos in this, which Russell T. Davies was very excited about. He thought he was going to have to get sound-alikes, and everybody he wanted said yes and came in and did the thing. Let's see.
He loves a timely media cameo.
Yeah. I think that's basically it. It was still a big shock, you know, the whole thing was a big shock. And, for a lot of people that weren't like following the news, I guess. This is like a really important ending to that first series. And they were, I think they were renewed for like 2 seasons at the end of this. Which was a big surprise. So, it's good. This is the start of like where we're at now, you know, mm-hmm. And it all happened because, they stuck the landing on this one. Good stuff. Where does that take us, Cass? Where do we start with Bad Wolf?
I think it's funny cause we've already been talking for like 45 minutes. So the TARDIS crew are transmatted out of the TARDIS and separated in classic Doctor Who fashion. They all end up in different like game show future places. Rose is in Weakest Link and the Doctor's in Big Brother, and I don't know what Jack is in, but he's getting a makeover with two robot ladies.
It's a show that didn't make it called over here. What is the show called? I'm trying to look for it. What Not to Wear is what the show is called.
Oh, okay.
Oh, I've heard of that.
And it, like, they don't really understand, like, a lot of the other people who are in these game shows with them are, like, distraught at being in these, and they don't really understand why until, like, they see that the losers are getting, like, disintegrated on live television. The first part is them trying to find each other. Rose, unfortunately, gets zapped because she doesn't know future trivia. Mm-hmm. They think she's dead, and then the episode ends with the reveal that she's not dead, but she has been transported to a Dalek ship that's hiding in deep space.
Mm-hmm. Dalek mothership.
Yeah.
Part of a Dalek fleet.
I like the reveal a lot.
The reveal is really good. It's really funny watching this and realizing that they only built 3 Daleks. There's only 3 physical Daleks. Everything else is like cardboard and CGI, like everything, which is really funny. Anything to save a buck. Yeah. So
a thought that I had.
Yes.
Early on. So listeners, Cass, Scott, a couple episodes back, I believe I said, you know, my favorite companions are the weirdos, you know, mm-hmm. your Susans, your Aces, mm-hmm. your, you know, the companions that are most likely to like set something on fire when you're not looking at them. Mm-hmm. And I was somewhat disparaging or dismissive of, I think my words, the ingenue companion.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, your Roses, your Amy Ponds, they don't have any personalities. They're just played by cool people, you know, blah, 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 blah. So I would just say, watching this episode, specifically Bad Wolf, throughout, Rose Tyler's a legend. Like, that's her personality. Yes. Her quirk is that she's an icon.
Yeah, it's true.
And so, yeah, just watching her just play weakestly and just laugh, cackling in the face of people who just have been sent to death, having no idea what's going on. It was a trip.
Yeah. What did you guys think of Linda with a Y as this sort of like almost companion?
Would you call it a fake out, like a fake out companion?
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
I think so. They've done
Can
that.
Can you remember, Cass?
Russell Please. Does that a couple of times because he also does it with Astrid in Voyage of the Damned.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Cass, can you remember wanting or thinking Linda with a Y would make a good companion, or kind of like, I know what you're doing, Doctor Who, like this?
Well, she's better than Adam or whatever that asshole's named, the one that he picks up. And I don't know. I like her. I think she's cute. I think it's really funny that like Russell T just has a thing for like blondes, I guess, because like she's blonde and like Astrid's blonde and like now Ruby's blonde.
Wow.
But no, I don't think I would be mad about, because I kind of like, now that I've seen like, you know, like all of Classic Who, I like the dynamic. If there's like multiple companions of one being from, of them being from like two different, like distinct periods mm-hmm. of time, like, mm-hmm. Like the, like Jamie being from the 1800s or 1700s and Zoe, who you haven't met yet, Nick, but Zoe being from like the far future and like how they play off of each other. I like that dynamic a lot. So I think mm-hmm. if she had continued, I think the dynamic would have been really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if Jack had stayed too, like the TARDIS would have been really full, but I'm like Whoa. Thinking about,
that's a fun party.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that I like about Linda, or I guess what struck me about Linda this time, was like, her personality is like the epitome of like half of Classic Who companions. Like, she kind of reminds me of Joe a little bit. You know, she kind of reminds me of Mel a little bit.
Yeah.
Like she has this very like Classic Who vibe about her in terms of her, I don't know, companion possibilities. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
She's an interesting character. I really like her in this, and I like her interacting with Eccleston. Yeah.
One thing I appreciate kind of bleeding into Parting of the Ways is like, she doesn't fail. She doesn't do anything wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right.
To like, there's no moment where the Doctor was like, I guess she wouldn't have made a good companion or something like that. Like, she is taken like away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, the whole arc of these two episodes, I think, is the Doctor's slowly losing control mm-hmm. and realizing like, oh, wait, oh, no, I think I might have messed everything up. And her being like a casualty of that, of like, wow, she probably would have been a really good companion, but like, Look at the situation that we got ourselves in, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. A couple of other small roles I just want to mention. Got to talk about Wonka's Patterson Joseph.
Yeah.
as Roderick. Patterson Joseph, of course, the just since 2005 are just like the ongoing almost doctor. Every time the doctor is going to regenerate, he's always on the books as like an odds on favorite every single time over in England, because he's a big West End actor. And he's sort of like perfect for the doctor in terms of like the level of notoriety he's at and all of this stuff. And that has never changed ongoing. It's like even as late as Capaldi, he was like, you know, an odds on favorite, as like, oh, he's going to be the 12th doctor. He was in the mix for the 9th doctor, in the mix for the 10th, in the mix for the 11th and the 12th. Yeah, it was just like an ongoing thing.
From the outside, from an outsider American perspective, yeah, he kind of feels like he was occupying the same space as Peter Capaldi, mm-hmm, of like beloved UK character actor, like hidden secret that, mm-hmm, like finally gets this star making shot well into like middle age or whatever.
Yeah.
He's delightful in Wonka, quite frankly.
Yes, he is. He's very good.
As Slugworth.
Yes. Yeah, he's great.
And he's delightful in this, too. He's a nasty bloke.
Oh, man. What a slime ball. Like, I was watching this, and I was just like, yeah, he's just Slugworth. Like, that is, like it was just so funny having those back-to-back watching these, because it was just like, I am sure you have played a bajillion different roles between those two, but it's really funny that back to back, the two things that I just saw you in were you playing Slugworth twice. Yeah. I don't know. So anyway, so that's Patterson Joseph, our almost every doctor. And then I wanted to shout out, because I just noticed him this time, an actor by the name of Dominic Burgess. He was like the last contestant,
yeah, the in last the weakest guy to link get vaporized. To get killed.
Yeah. And yeah, he is in everything. Like, it's so funny because in 2005 he was only in this and Batman Begins. And then, you know, really just like a struggling actor trying to get roles here and there. And then somewhere around like 2010, he just started, like, he got, I don't know, his look down or whatever, but he has been in no less than like 30 roles every year since.
Wow.
It's just nuts. Like, he's in everything. It was fun seeing him here this early on, but it is just like, yeah, it's bananas. He's in so many things. I immediately recognized him and was like, oh my God, it's that guy. And I looked him up and I was like, wow, this guy's in a lot of stuff. This is crazy.
Speaking of almost doctors, at first when I saw him, I think before he got like a close up, mm-hmm, because he is also a handsome man with prominent ears, I really thought that was Russell Tovey at first.
Oh.
And then I was like, oh wait, no, different guy.
Wait, are you talking about the younger guy? The one that, like,
no, the last one, the one who gets vaporized, and then the Slugworth guy is like, your next rose.
Oh, that's, yeah, okay, yeah, person. Yeah, 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 okay. We're,
that's
talking
the person
about
the
same
I thought
person.
Was Russell
too. Yeah, but yeah, he's very good.
The kind of added like stake or whatever or notch, mm-hmm, against Rose of like she's also getting asked like future trivia questions.
Uh-huh. Yes. And still getting some of them right,
yeah.
which is good. Yeah, I think the bit in this that works the least for me, is weirdly the what not to wear sequences, just because like I don't understand what the fuck this show is. Like, I don't know what the like, why are we just doing outfits if you're just going to do plastic surgery later? And how do you win this? I don't really understand like the rules that are at play in this one, because it's supposed to be a game show. So what's the game, I guess?
Yeah, I don't know how what not to wear works in real life. So yeah. Like, I had the very dark thought at some point of like, what is an episode of this show normally like? Because I just have to assume that most contestants aren't in as chipper a mood as Jack is.
Right.
Like, yeah. Are they just like terror? It's like a hostile situation. Are they just terrorizing a person until they kill them?
Oh, right. Oh God. Yeah, you're right. Oh my God. That is horrifying. They're just like shaking naked as they force them to put on outfits and then sew their head to their butt.
Unless they are somehow able to centralize, because we're led to believe that citizens of Earth are chosen at random, transmatted at random. So like, I have to assume at least most of them are aware of the show's concept, the way that like we all know what The Masked Singer is about.
Right.
Even if we've never like watched it.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like that was a very dark thought that I had.
That's really dark. And I'm just not a fan of the gun in the butt jokes. Like
gun
I just
up the butt.
I've seen that gag more times than you'd think. In stuff, and it just doesn't work for me. I don't know.
It's edgy, and I'm just
Yeah.
And like, not to be, I'll be the wet blanket to bring this up, but it is an aspect of the show that has age. It's just like horn dog Captain Jack, like grabsy Captain Jack just doesn't.
No.
Right.
It's not fun to watch now in 2024. Like,
it's not.
He gropes one of the robots at some point.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of a throwaway moment, but
It's very, I don't know. Yeah. No, totally. But I don't know. It's fun. I like what it says. Like Cass was talking about, I like what it's saying about like society and like how you can easily placate a society with this stuff, and also placate and like desensitize them over time. Yeah. Yeah.
Please.
You know what the story is?
Hmm.
It's vengeance on Veros.
Yep.
But you know, game show. Instead
and,
of
and better
torture porn. Yes, yes.
But yes, that's, but you know what? Vengeance on Vero shows people watching the show.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
A thought that I'm forming as I'm trying to verbalize it just now is like the aspect of citizens being dragged against their will at random to compete in these life or death games. It kind of almost reminds me of now with social media and phones, how like any human going out to like the store now can against their will be caught on camera and become a viral thing and suddenly belong to everyone.
Right. That's very true.
So
because there's like an aspect of it doesn't have like the pageantry of like the Hunger Games or whatever, but like, you know, like there's an aspect of that too, where it's like suffering for entertainment.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
And
it weirdly, that part, that aspect of it holds up even if the games themselves don't.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is why I just, but I can just sort of be like, well, you know, it was 2005. It's fine. You know, I just let that roll off my back. But I think that it's very poignant satire.
And it made me excited for, I mean, we've already seen a little bit of it with Church on Ruby Road with like, that real life television presenter playing herself.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to Google her name really quick while talking and I couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. But to see what he has to say about 2020s pop culture with potentially the season being like somewhat fantasy inspired, like who knows what's going to happen.
Very true. So I think that brings us into the parting of the ways.
Yes.
Yeah.
Real quick, I wanted to highlight one scene that happens. I think it's in Bad Wolf, where he is told by Linda with a Y that they are on Satellite 5 and that this is the same timeline as The Long Game. There's this scene where Eccleston is like, oh yeah, I remember that. It was super easy. I didn't even sweat, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of a B minus adventure for me, if I'm being honest.
Right.
And Linda's not even with anger or malice is like, oh yeah, that effed us, that screwed us forever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was the start of all of this.
Yeah, that decision you made, it had lasting consequences, and now we're in a freaking dystopia. And that hitting 9 and him being like, oh, I made this world, like this is my fault, like I really vibe with that this time around. I like how it's kind of making the Doctor reckon with this. Like you said, Scott, this is kind of just like a day on the job. This isn't like a prophesized adventure that he's going
on. Right, right. I I'm laughing because I'm imagining that meme of the, you made this, I made this. That the art theft internet meme. And then, but sure, I'm thinking about in the context of this episode of like, you all did this. I did this.
I did this.
Well, because like how often in Classic Who does the Doctor like deal with the ramifications of an adventure? Like, does he ever go back to any of them? Like, I mean, I guess there's like a handful of times where he goes back to a place he's been before.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think this is new for him.
Yeah.
You know, like.
Certainly if it's happened before, it's been like for, it's like a plot kind of like, oh, it's 400 years later. It's not like challenging the character the way that it is in this.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. There is definitely the it's never challenging the character, without a doubt. It's also interesting because he's so quick. The Doctor has always been so quick to judge. And just be like, ugh, you humanity, they're making me sick with your stupid reality television and sitting on the couch getting fat, or whatever she says, or whatever he says. And then she's just like, actually, this is your fault. And he was like, my fault? Oh, you know? Just like, yeah, just instantly being like, oh, I probably shouldn't have said all those mean things. Sorry. Yeah.
Or even like, you know, like I can rattle off Doctor Who episodes that have ended with him like pulling plugs out of things and like completely upending a society and being like, you're free.
Right.
Goodbye.
Right.
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 Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
But yeah.
But
parting of the ways.
Parting of the ways.
Parting of the ways is mostly Dalek nonsense, which is one of my favorite things about Doctor Who.
Yes.
The Daleks are invading the Satellite 5, and there's a lot of dead people in this story, which is... And a lot of guns. I didn't remember all the guns.
A lot of guns.
Yeah. Kind of... like I thought about that too, Cass, during this, and like... I love action movies like in a vacuum, but like guns and Doctor Who just are always going to be like not a fun combo for me, or I have a limited appetite for it, I think.
Yeah. Especially like as this character has evolved over the, I don't know, 14 seasons or whatever it is now that we've had New Who.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was just kind of derivative the way it was shot in this, like the gun hallway battles. But Scott, did you find yourself thinking thoughts like that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think they're just doing their best with what they've got, resources wise. And you know, I mean, God, we've seen hella worse in Classic Who.
That's true.
But yeah, like you know, shooting guns down hallways. I mean, that's just, that is classic Doctor Who 101. Sure. You know,
yeah.
Oh man.
The cutting to one shot of like a mine going off in a dirt field and people. Ah.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Speaking of like low budget Doctor Who shots, the. The little model of the spinning TARDIS flying through space and then the missiles being shot at it by the Dalek ship is my favorite part of this whole episode.
Yeah, it's really good.
It's great.
I guess the Dalek's plan, which is to harvest you know, DNA material of humans to make more Daleks after, like, you know, they're trying to, like, rebuild from the Time War. And it's interesting because this sets up, like, a long ongoing thread about, you know, the Daleks, like, mixing human DNA with themselves. So we get that really awful story in Series 3. With good old Andy Garfield, and Pigman, and it's interesting because they, I guess, you know, I don't know. Maybe his thought process behind that was like he was thinking about like, one, how do I show how low the Daleks have sunk? And how desperate they are to survive. And it's like, oh, they're like mixing their DNA with humanity. That's like, that would be a nightmare for them because they're, you know, Nazis. Which I guess is interesting. It's also, I find it like kind of weirdly metatextually interesting because of like the whole like Eighth Doctor, like half human thing that had just happened. Like it was like the last thing we saw in Doctor Who before this series. Also, and the reason that I almost wonder if it's not an accident that that's intentional somehow is because we also see the Doctor kissing his companion in this, which was a big to do in the Eighth Doctor TV movie. So I don't know. It almost feels like he was kind of playing with that stuff. It also feels like a very Russell T. Davies thing to just sort of poke fun at people being grumpy about like adding new elements to Doctor Who. I don't know. What do you guys think about those things? The Eighth Doctor references or inadvertent references?
I didn't even pick up on that.
Oh,
I think that's interesting. I thought that because I couldn't really remember a whole lot about this two-parter. So I thought that the because like Rose points out that's like, oh, that means they're half human. I thought that was going to kind of play more of a role in like wrapping up the plot of this episode in some way. Like that's the way that he defeats them somehow. But no, I think if it is a reference to the Eight movie, I think that's really interesting and funny.
The thing that I found really engaging and cool about the Daleks in this episode is their like newfound zealotry, which I mean, like, and Eccleston nails it because, again, this was my first Who finale. I had no context for how the Daleks were supposed to be acting, but just how disturbed he is when they accuse him of blasphemy. And they're like, since when do you guys care about blasphemy? And like, that's the, like, he's like, that's not good. They found religion. And now that I've like kind of know with the context of these characters more, hearing them use words like Eden and, you know, the promised land and, you know, this God, the emperor being their God was like kind of a newly disturbing to me to watch.
Yeah. I, you know, it's so funny. Anytime the Daleks do something, like anytime the Daleks act like humans, it's either the most horrifying shit you've ever seen or absolutely like adorable and hilarious.
Finally.
It's one or the other.
Like, I think that's why episodes like Resolution of the Daleks or the one where Clara's trapped inside of one for a little bit, like those are so disturbing because you hear them try to be more human or act more human.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, Daleks are great in this. So I really like all of that. And I like the bit. I think one of my favorite, I guess like the epitome of Nine to me is the scene where, Nine and Rose are in the control room, whatever you want to call it. And they're like, you know, pushing cable, like plugging cables together and doing their whole thing. And there's a moment where he realizes that it's not going to work. And you just see him like lower his head. And then she's like, what is it? What's wrong? And then he pops up and he's like, ah, like you're brilliant, blah, blah, blah. And gets so excited and runs her into the TARDIS and then runs out and then immediately gets out again and sends her away. And just like put on a whole show for her to get her to leave because he knows that like she's going to die otherwise. Love that. That's like peak Nine for me is that whole thing. Because he's, you know, he's sort of the doctor that is, masking you know, like that, yeah. That psychological, that is him. That is, he is the masking doctor. Like that's, he has so much pain, but he puts on a mask and pretends to be light as a feather and, you know, goofy and whatever, but he's like harboring so much. And mm-hmm. so like that little moment is just such a, like, that is the Ninth Doctor to me. Like that would be like if I was like, you know, making an award ceremony and I had to pick a clip to represent nine, it would be that clip. Mm-hmm.
There's another much smaller moment at the beginning of the episode where, for lack of a better term, they're being hailed by the Daleks mm-hmm. and they have that like screen to screen confrontation. And he does that as well, where he kind of has that like big grin on his face for them. But then the camera lingers on his face and you see the smile fade and like the tiredness and the weariness of like, oh yeah. Like, and now with my future knowledge of War Doctor and stuff like that, I'm like putting so much more on that small choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's really good.
He's very good.
He's really good. And it makes me sad that we will likely never see him on camera as the Doctor ever again. Makes me very sad.
Yeah. Maybe we just got to wait him out, man.
Yeah.
We got to keep him alive until he's 90 and desperate.
Man.
No.
No.
Just to reiterate again, Billy Piper is just acting this yeah. entire episode.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you guys think about Rose back on, you know, in 2005 London, that whole sequence? What do you guys think about all of that?
That hellhole.
Yeah.
I'm of two minds about it. Like, first of all, I feel bad for the other people in this restaurant that she's yelling in. But like, she's like, yeah, like she's going through it, but also like, I don't know. It's kind of whiny. Like I like Rose a lot, but I don't know that that's like my favorite Rose moment, you mm-hmm. know, like mm-hmm. She's so young, like
right. Yeah. She's like 19.
Yeah. I don't know what it is with Russell T and blonde 19-year-olds, but
we're really narrowing it down now.
Well, no, because we have another one. Now.
I know.
It's like the so it's like weird. the Doofenshmirtz.
Yes, yeah, yeah, two nickels. But like I think Billy Piper's doing a really good job with the material. I don't know.
I mean, it's very soapy and very
yeah.
like, melodramatic. Yes. And she's just like, I don't belong in this shop with you in this piece of shit yeah. town. And I guess what my note was like, God, like this is so much more than other companions have been given in the past.
Yeah. And it's very heightened.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
they also, like, they all will not give her the benefit of the doubt of, like, whenever she says that stuff, they're just like, oh, I worked in a shop. What the fuck? What's wrong with me?
You think you're better than
like,
me? Yeah.
You want to fight about it?
Yeah.
And she's like,
yeah.
No, that's not what I mean. And I was like, they know that that's not what you mean. They're just being assholes. They're, like, getting, like, faux offended at, like,
oh, yeah, well,
you know.
Yeah, where it's like, you can't tell, just use your emotional intelligence to be like, oh, she's a young woman who's just been through this crazy experience,
right.
And now it was being told it's done, and you're back where you were before.
Yeah. Right.
But is that kind of weirdly a relatable experience to people of like, I'm not saying I'm better than you, I'm just saying like,
yeah.
I think I need more, I need something different than what works for you guys.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. I mean, growing up in the Midwest, I mean, that's just, you know,
also having just returned home from the holidays, the scene in that booth where it's just Jackie and Mickey talking about restaurants that have recently closed and restaurants that have recently opened.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
Towny shit. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Very accurate.
It's also funny to refer to Mickey and Jackie as townies because they live in London.
Like, no, I know, but like, yeah, but... she's been, because she's like, she's a time traveler now.
I know.
You know, contextually.
Yeah, right. But I also love that scene because Mickey and Jackie are like, that scene is well directed because Mickey and Jackie are sitting across from Rose, you know? So they're like separate, so like they're like a little team. They're a little unit. Where you would think that Mickey being like as annoying of a lapdog as he is, that he would be like all like really snugged up to Rose and be like, you're not leaving this time. You're my girlfriend. You know,
it says a lot because, again, I haven't seen this episode in a long time. So the part where she gets faked out and juked out and the TARDIS, you know, evaporates without her and then you see Mickey sprinting towards her down the street. My first feeling was dread.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Oh, no.
I wasn't like, oh, good old Mickey. He'll make her feel better. It's like, God, it's the last thing she needs right now.
Yeah, I know.
Captain Boyfriend.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Why are you crying? It's not because of me, is it? It's because of him. That's why you're crying.
I'm honestly really glad that after next week we're kind of done with Mickey.
I'm so excited to talk about Doomsday version of him.
Yeah, yeah. We'll get there, but it's I just don't like Mickey at all. I think he's a bad character and a bad person.
How long have you been waiting to say that?
He's the worst. Anyway.
He's kind of like, it's kind of the Xander effect where it's gone from
very much so.
Yeah. Like it's gone from endearing to like pathetic. Like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And just like Anya, you're like, oh, Martha, you deserve so much better than Mickey.
Oh my God.
Well, like, to follow this train and to kind of talk a little bit about the next season finale, it kind of is the Xander effect because he gets more insufferable to me when the show starts trying to make him cool.
Yep.
Mm.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Because nothing about his personality changes.
He just starts dressing like Nick Fury.
You're right. It's true. Oh man. Rose offends Mickey and Jackie multiple times, and then tells Jackie on the TARDIS that she was like, just to like, she's like, look, I'm trying to say that he showed me all of this really amazing stuff that was really fulfilling and big, and we were helping people, and now I can't do things at that level anymore, and it's a lot to let go of. Just for example, throwing this out there, I met Dad, I was the lady that was with him when he died, and Jackie's like, fuck you, and then just leaves.
Back to like tying the whole season together though.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I love that moment. And then, you know, Mickey being like, no, look, I get it. You know, I may be an asshole, but I understand. And tries to help her out, but he's got a little dinky car that isn't going to be enough. I don't know how or why Jackie knew to drive a truck over there. I don't know who took that phone call or whatever. I'm not sure how that worked, but she shows up and pulls that thing off and the TARDIS is gone. And then we get the whole weird glowy vortex angel thing, which what is that? Is that Astrid, for lack of a better term, inside of her?
No, it says, like, because she refers to it as the heart of the TARDIS, and then he calls it the time vortex. So, like,
yeah,
she embodies, like, the time vortex.
But why is that inside the TARDIS?
I don't know.
It's like gasoline, I guess?
Yeah.
It's like what's powering it?
Because season one Doctor Who.
No, yeah. No, I know. I guess in for me, I guess, I don't know, maybe this is my own personal retcon, but to me, it feels that like that is Astrid, like basically, like in a human body, because then it's like, oh, Neil Gaiman saw this and was like, oh, you can put it in a human body and it'll burn through the human body, so it can't stick around for very long. And we could do a whole episode where he meets her and like gets to like talk to her and, you know, befriend her or whatever. So to me, I don't know. This reads as like she's got the TARDIS inside of her and like Astrid and the Doctor's wife. But
it's crazy to think about Neil Gaiman watching this in his study.
Yeah.
In 2005.
But he did. He's a huge Doctor Who fan, you know?
He's a huge nerd.
Yeah. Which I love.
And then meanwhile, arguably the A plot, or you know, happening back and forth, is the kind of like overwhelming dread inducing slaughter of all of the characters that we met in Bad Wolf, as the Daleks just won't stop coming and the Doctor is just running out of allies. And it's, you know, yeah, it by the time we get to the end of it, you're like, geez, this is heavy.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Like all the scientists, and the way that Linda especially goes out is pretty brutal. She gets like sucked into space.
Yeah,
that's rough.
I like I like how that scene is done though, because like the Dalek lights do the thing when they say exterminate in the cadence, so you can like, even though it's silent, like you can tell what they're gonna.
Yeah,
that's very good.
That's good. It's shit great. For sure. love that. Yeah. So, Jack's dead. Long live Jack.
Good riddance.
Yeah. but basically, yeah.
Oh, I guess this isn't like an important moment, but like he, you know, he says goodbye to Rose and the Doctor before the big shootout begins, and he like romantically kisses both of them in a Jack Harkness way. And I guess it just struck me how, like, you know, how kids of our generation grew up with this show and how, like, this show has been kind of used to explore, like, you know, like a certain kind of kid grows up watching the show and then, like, becomes a certain kind of adult. And now here we are in the 2020s when this has become newly politicized. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, that moment was like, I don't know if poignancy even the right word, but it just kind of was like, oh, this has always been part of the show. And why?
Oh yeah, for sure. Especially Russell T. Davies' take on the show. He's always used it as a Trojan horse to introduce things to younger kids, right? As like, see, like, who cares? Like, whatever. Like, look, he kisses her, he kisses him, whatever. Like, it means the same thing. It's good. And
he's a little Johnny Bravo. He's problematic now, but like in some ways, would you call Captain Jack like a character ahead of his time?
I think so. I don't think we even have a term for like pansexuality back then.
I don't. If we did, like, I wasn't up on the like the lingo.
Yeah.
You know? Like,
yeah.
And I remember a lot of my like. Despite all of my feelings on Torchwood as a show, like I remember that being like very important to a subset of my friends, like of my like LGBTQ friends, because like there was like an openly gay like romantic relationship on that show and it was not a big deal at all. And like, so I think that, you know, despite him not aging particularly well, I think Captain Jack is important for that reason. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, you kind of watch the TV to dream. And so, like, seeing this, like, swashbuckling handsome man kiss both the maiden and the Doctor because he's like, I might die. I think you're both hot. Like,
yeah.
That, right.
It's like, man, that's really cool that he did that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was an important thing back then because, like you know, there was no representation like that really on television,
right.
Or at least not. You had to hunt for it at least at the time. And you certainly didn't have that. You had that representation in things like Russell T. Davies' Queer as Folk, but that was a show that was about that. You didn't get a lot of that representation in other stuff that wasn't about
genre stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So it was really cool to see. And now here we are in 2024, and he is doing it again, but on a grander scale, because he's like, well, you know, all the stuff that I was doing back then, we've had on television now ever since. So now I'm going to start bringing in like bigger queer concepts and more complicated, complex stuff. And I'm just going to treat it like it's nothing and just another thing. And I adore that about Russell T. Davies. I just think that it's so cool that he does it. And I know that there is an element, especially with some of like the Gen Zers who really loved the Whitaker era, have complicated feelings about Russell T. Davies. And they, like, you know, they call him like, you know, an old man and, you know, old man, like trying his best at the thing or whatever. But I don't know. There's something to be said about someone who can, like Barbie, right? Could Barbie have been more complex with its depiction of feminism? Sure. But is that what the point of that movie was? No. The point of that movie was to present a very easy, like, definition of feminism to a new generation of girls who might not be getting raised in families who have that. And again, a Trojan horse. And so here we go again with more Trojaning, and I just love it. I think it's great, and I think it's really important. And I love Russell T. Davies for it. I think it's great. And it's crazy that it's like this far back he was already doing it treating it like just throwing it away, you know? I love that.
It's really interesting that inside of this big, colossal franchise that's like big money and big business for the BBC, we have this example of like an authorial voice, like an album. You can go back and like listen, watch this episode and then kind of think about, wow, this guy really has, as a writer and as a person, like done a lot of growing, and like life is like, and the art that he's experienced and has kind of shifted his voice. Now we get to see that in New Who. That's cool. I don't know. You don't get that a lot.
Yeah, it's true. So then comes, so that Rose comes back and she, you know, wrecks shit and then brings Jack back to life. And then, Nine makes out with her to like suck up all that energy.
He does not make out
with
her.
Well, I mean,
it's a swoon. He kisses her. It's very romantic. It's not making out.
It's an extended
kiss. It is a swooning romantic kiss. And I want to talk about the line, "I think you need a doctor."
Okay.
Because it shook me.
So smooth. So smooth.
Yeah.
I was like, are you kidding me? That's insane. I
like it in terms of like, yeah, the romance of it all is what it is. But I think that like from a Ninth Doctor's perspective, who is not to me a romantic doctor except outside of this moment, to me, it feels very much like he's like, I'm going to sweep her off her feet with a kiss that is going to absolutely knock her socks off to completely distract her from the fact that I'm gonna kill myself. That's like how it reads to me now. And I kind of love that about it. And I do think it directly leads to the swashbuckling romantic figure that is the 10th Doctor, as Nick alluded to at the beginning of this episode. But yeah, I don't know. It's a great moment. I love it. Cass, do you have other feelings about?
I think I'm taking umbrage with like, he's not romantic at all. You don't think like Rose and the Doctor dancing in Empty Child Doctor Dances is romantic?
No.
What?
No, I don't. The age gap is too much for me. It's not. It doesn't read as romantic. It reads like if Giles and Buffy were dancing. Like that's not romantic. I don't know.
That's fair. I don't know. I feel like at least from like Rose's point of view, like, cause like Rose is like absolutely into the Doctor
for sure.
And like, there's kind of like a tension there, and the Doctor's just like, I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah.
And especially like every time Mickey's around, you know, because mm-hmm. it's like, then there's the weird love triangle thing. But like, I don't know. Maybe it's just because I like Rose and 9 more than I like Rose and 10. But
yeah.
And it feels like, I guess going back to every next Doctor being a response or a reply to the previous Doctor.
Yeah, yeah.
I do kind of get like low-key, like kind of lover, leather jacket, cool guy, 9, like 9 vibe sometimes. But also he's like seems much more uncomfortable or like awkward with it. And then we get to 10, who's like, guess who worked through all of that?
Yeah. Did you wish really hard?
Get ready for a 2-year long date.
Yeah.
I'm conventionally attractive now.
Yeah.
Right. I and closer to your age. Visually. yeah.
We'll get to that. We'll get to 10 being like, she's almost 40. And I'm like, okay, 34-year-old David Tennant. Like, calm down.
I don't know. I always read it as a very one-sided romance from like a little girl with a crush on a really like cool guy. you know, it's like, it's not quite like the Martha 10 relationship because that is a lot more like that has a lot more patheticness drenched all over it. Unfortunately. But yeah, it just doesn't, it, like I said, it feels like if Buffy had a crush on Giles, it's like, he's not going to do anything about it. It's
right,
just, yeah.
Right. And like, I think the Buffy Giles thing isn't like 100% because like, I don't really view 9 as like a mentor figure.
I do,
you know, like 7 and Ace, like, you know, she's always calling him professor or whatever. There's like an ambiguity to their relationship that feeds into the romance. I think.
It's almost kind of like a biker taking a chick from a deserted town. Like, I'm going to show you like the big city. And it's like, not quite like, come young, I'm your professor, I'm your mentor. But it is somewhat of a, like the more kind of like world weary dude who's been around town showing the like townie from London like the whole universe.
Mm-hmm. It's not quite like father daughter vibes, like mentor whatever vibes, but it does feel much more like a like I don't know, like a boss taking an employee under their wing kind of way to me. It just does not, it reads very platonic even if she has a crush on him. That crush feels very one-sided until David Tennant shows up, and then it becomes it becomes text at that point. But for better or worse, depending on who you ask. And if you ask me, it's for the worst. Not the worst, the worst. trademark, copyright. Anyway, more on that next week. And then we get this this great scene of Eccleston explaining regeneration just before he does it, and maybe one of my favorite final Doctor lines of all time. The "you were fantastic, absolutely fantastic, and you know what? So was I." So good. It just gave me chills just saying it. A little bit. It's such a good line. It's such a good line. Absolutely adore it. I don't know. What do you guys think about Eccleston's actual regeneration and that whole scene?
I have a question for both of you. Is this the first, because when I think the line, and you know what, so was I, even watching it as a kid and you know, back in 2005, a part of me understood that that line was supposed to be metatextual.
Mm-hmm.
It was the actor Christopher Eccleston saying, you know what, I did a pretty good job. And it was RTD, the writer, saying, you know, using like, I'm going to pat this guy on the back because, you know, give it up for Christopher Eccleston, everybody. Mm-hmm. Is that the first time the show had done that with a final line, with having it have some kind of meta aspect to it?
No, because the post-regeneration of 6 was very meta. where he gets up and he's like, she's like, what happened? And he goes, change, my dear. And not a moment too soon, and stares directly down the barrel of the camera.
but that's like his first line.
Yeah. That's
like
his first line. Yeah. But it's still meta as hell.
Cause now it almost seems like a second job the line has to do. Like,
right. That's true.
In addition to working in the episode, it has to kind of also sort of say something about this run of the show.
That's true. You know, that's the other thing too, that I think I really love about this. And again, I think it just goes back to like what we were talking about earlier in terms of like, oh, is this the best regeneration story? And it's like, well, the show wasn't as popular as it would be. And so it doesn't have to do as much heavy lifting as the other ones. But yeah. I love how fast this is. I love that it's not dragged out. Like, it's just like, oh, so this thing is about to happen. We've got about 30 seconds. So I'm going to be like, adios, sign it off, see you around. And then boom, it's done. Instead of like, oh, so this time the way the regeneration works is I'm not an old man anymore. And now I look like you remember me, and it seems like everything's going to be fine. And I'm going to be able to be like this for as long as it takes me to say goodbye to you. And then I'm going to like, you know, snap into Peter Capaldi or whatever, or I'm going to monologue.
Walk off into the,
you know,
I'm going to walk out into the woods behind the yard.
Yeah. Right. Or I'm going to monologue alone talking to my next iteration, which is very weird because it's the same person. You're just talking to yourself. Or you know, 10 being like, oh, it has started. I've got just enough time to spend the next 2 weeks saying goodbye to everyone I've ever met. You know, I just like that this is just like, oh, it's about to happen. Oh, it's happening. It's nice. I don't know. It's a nice change of pace from what we've gotten used to, I think.
That's fair.
Yeah.
It's what I thought the fake out with 14 was going to be for a second.
That's true. Right. That's true. It's very true. And the fake out from 10.
The greatest.
Which was one of the greatest cliffhangers of all time and one of the worst payoffs of a cliffhanger
ridiculous.
Of all time. But god damn, was that cliffhanger one of the greatest cliffhangers I've ever seen. My god. Wow. Anyway.
Even though his nine's clothes are more casual than his proper costume, mm-hmm. every time you see David Tennant for the first time in the nine costume, to me, he never looks younger.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Eggleston is quite a bit larger of a man than David Tennant, especially back then. Because, he was so young. I think, wasn't he the youngest doctor ever at the time?
10?
Yeah.
I think he was a couple years older than
Davison.
Than Peter Davison, yeah.
Okay, all right.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Because I thought that Matt Smith was the youngest since Peter Davison, but
But David Tennant is just, I mean, he's a baby in this. It's mm-hmm. ridiculous. And yeah, you're right, Nick. It just swallows him a little bit, that costume.
I'm a little baby in a big man jacket.
Yeah, he just looks like he's wearing like dad's coat. It's good. And then our first look at David Tennant, as the doctor, which was, very, I don't know. It's everything I love about Doctor Who. You know, that first image of the next doctor is just always so exciting. Unless they frame it weird and ruin it. Sorry, I don't want to just go completely drag on 13, but that really did annoy me at the time, because I wanted to meet her, and we didn't really get to, because they had weird close-ups and out of focus rack shots. I don't know, it was weird. anyway, I love this. I really, really enjoyed rewatching this, and I'm sad to say goodbye to 9, but, you know, dem's the breaks. That's how.
His last words.
Yeah, right. Oh, man. Yeah. So, anyway. Any closing thoughts on 9 or parting of the ways or anything? No?
Yeah, no, I am going to miss 9. I think every time I rewatch series 1, I gain more appreciation for what he's doing, as the Doctor, and like the nuance of the performance. Cause like, you know, at first glance he is kind of like goofy, but then like when he goes like genocidal doctor mode, you know, it's like legitimately, it's compelling and it's like horrifying, because it's like this is this character that we've been falling in love with and then like following for 13 episodes. So it's like he's doing so much heavy lifting in this, and it's like really setting the foundation for like what this show becomes in the future. So I think doing this way has given me like yet another like appreciation for what he did.
Nick, thoughts?
Yeah, it's gonna miss talking about this brief but extremely pivotal season of Doctor Who.
Yeah I think it's Eccleston, man, it's a good time, but it's also, you know, with all the things that you were talking about, Cass, like all of the heavy lifting that he's doing, like sort of in his acting and, you know, and on his face and all this character that he built into this to like really sell this new idea of being last of the Time Lords is really, I guess it adds more poignancy to his decision to leave during the production of Aliens of London in World War III, because here he is bringing all of this like gravitas and drama and then being like, but like fat farting aliens, right? That's great.
Yeah.
And him just being like, what am I doing? You know, like I'm giving this show my all and this is what they're giving me back.
Like he's there 100% of the time.
Yeah. All the way through the end, you know?
Yeah.
Cause he was like, no, I'm out, I'm done, but I'm not going to half ass this at any point. I just don't want to do this after this. And he just absolutely wrecks it all the way to the end. That's 9, closing the book on our first Doctor, which is sad, but you know,
toss it into that big vortex where all of the Time Lord consciousness float around.
Yeah.
Remember that?
yeah. Because unlike 6, you know, we're not going to continue with the big finish stuff. So, you know, we've got plenty of 6 in our future, but 9 is 9's done. He's cooked, finished. also cooked and finished is Rose, as we'll find out next week.
I'm Rose Tyler. This is the story of how I got cooked.
This is the story of how I got cooked and died.
My shit wrecked, bruv.
Next week. Jump on the Discord if you're not there already. Check out duelinggenre.com/support if you want to support us on Patreon. We appreciate everyone who does that. And we'll be back next week to talk about the Series 2 finale, Army of Ghosts and Doomsday. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.